somehow they don't see the future.
No.
When technology is, they don't even want, they're not interested in taking the pain, putting money into technology. And you have to have that for advancement.
Mm-hmm. I think the space shuttle era was necessary, it's vital. We needed to know that America could design and build such a vehicle, reusable,
right.
You know, and push new technological envelopes for that and learn from that. But there are others that say, yes, but you know, the shuttle era went on too long, and that's probably, that may be true.
Oh yeah, I agree.
Because it is a quarter of a century old.
When
you say that to people, it's alarming, but it's true. Now, NASA did try to develop new vehicles, but that just didn't come about for some reason. Once they started with the space station, they were locked into a mode where they had to build these modules for the station,
right.
And only the shuttle could get it up there, so they had to stay with the shuttle.
Yeah.
And it's like they were locked into each other, and they couldn't extricate themselves.
You're right. And I don't know. I'm not sure where we're going.
Well, I think it would have continued if Columbia hadn't...
If Columbia had seen...
That's tragic, but that's a fact.
The tragic thing, in 86...
I watched that, you know. I was at the Cape when I watched
Columbia.
Challenger, yeah.
When Challenger went, we've been going down ever since Challenger because we didn't know how to handle a catastrophic situation.
Well, I saw a book at the history office about the Challenger launch decision. Big sick thing.
Yeah.
I'm glad somebody's finally written it, because it violated every launch constraint. They shouldn't have done
it.
What, you couldn't wait a week for warmer weather?
Yeah.
Somebody made the wrong decision. And it's like, and that's not what NASA does. NASA knows how, in the past, knew how to make right decisions, knew how to wait. I think now they're much more conservative about...
I think they're too conservative.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and you've got to have a balance there, but with Challenger, I was sitting there, I was on the console back in that day.
Yeah,
and
we're here in...
SSMA down here, you know, up at Marshall, and we had the chief engineer down, Jerry was down the Cape. We had Rocketdyne people here, and we had Rocketdyne people up here, what we call HOSC, the Huntsville Operations Center.
Yes.
And in fact, we had it was just like the Cape.
Yeah, it's basically okay.
And now it's not like that. I think it's more like, you know, how they monitor the space station and other probes. But back in that day, we were looking there, and ice was all over the testing.
Yes.
But a lot of them say, you know, the design, in my opinion, it wasn't designed. We launched in a condition that we had never tested for.
Right.
And we should never have launched.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody should have said, you know, I remember the press saying, you bunch of clowns, you know, it's the third time you scrubbed this launch. We had scrubbed twice.
Mm-hmm.
And the third time we were going to launch, you know, we were sitting there. And they said, what are you guys doing? I mean, but you shouldn't get the pressure of the press or anybody to say, hey, you need to do it. And you shouldn't get so complacent that you think you're God.
Mm-hmm.
NASA, a lot of guys thought, hey, we can't fail. Some guys said, hey, let's go ahead and launch. And we had never tested them. It was so cold. You know, temperatures that thick were in a condition there that we never tested that sonic rocket motor. And we should never have done that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we thought it was the SSME.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we were startled. They first thought it was a tank. The director, Martin Lewis, Lucas thought it was a tank.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We thought it was the engine. Mm-hmm. And then it was... When we showed the pictures, it was quite...
You know what? I was hired to work at Planet Research Corporation, like November of 85.
Yeah.
Right there in Cape Canaveral. My cube mate says, hey, let's go watch the Challenger launch. I said, okay. And everybody was. They all piled into their car. We drove up. There's a dog leg, a bend through the Cape, and then an exit to a drawbridge that leads into Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. So we parked the car, got it, just him and me. We walked up to the apex of the bridge and just stood there. We had a beeline right to the launch pad. So we just stood there, watch and wait, and they launched, and it went up. And it seemed to go up slow. It was just my perception. They go up at the same speed. But it went up, and then the cloud formed, and the booster started corkscrewing.
Oh, my God.
And this guy had worked on 39B. I think he had done work on it. Young, my age. I'm 56, but this is 20-some-odd years ago. And he started freaking out, of course. And everybody who knew the shuttle and the way it was built knew there was no crew escape of any kind. But it's like you still wished for some means of it coming out in the parachute. There is no parachute. It's just... It's a fantasy. And NASA's never built a manned vehicle that did not have a means of crew escape.
No, you're right. You're right.
And we all know the story behind all the budget finagling that prevented that from happening. But it was just shards. The only thing solid were the boosters. And they were going like this, totally, totally unguided. And it was horrific. We just stood there with our mouth open. So we raced back to the car, went back to work. There were already TVs on desks and they were on, and everybody's glued to the set. But we all knew, you know what, this is going to be bad for the Cape.
Yeah.
Bad for NASA, bad for the crew.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it was within a week, they had meetings, personnel called us and sat us down. And the first thing he said was, well, after I lay all of you off, I have to lay myself off, because we're not hiring anybody. So I was out of work for 3 months.
Oh, my God.
No engineer could get a job. It was a rough time for everybody.
It was a bad situation because I never went home for 3 days. I never slept for 3 days.
Yeah.
We were conditioned.
But you hadn't slept for a week before that.
Yeah, but we were in and out of there. It was a rough time because we took back in that day and I remember so vividly that we looked and people said, well, what did you do? Did you fall apart? And I said, we were not conditioned to fall apart.
Right.
We were conditioned to take and work data. And that's what we did. We started pulling data and said, hey, where can it fail? You know, where was the problem? We worked that on the engine. Tank people worked that on the tank.
Mm-hmm.
Solid rocket people did that on that, the booster people. And the both sides, you know, everybody was working that situation. But it's a sad situation. We should have just never lost that point. But
right. You always have time to wait. You don't have time to do it over.
No, you don't.
No. But they did. They must have had so much pressure to launch. But I don't know. Who's the administrator at the time?
That's
administrator.
Right now,
at the time of the Challenger.
Oh, the administrator was
Lucas or Fletcher?
Oh, you mean
not
NASA,
Fletcher. NASA administrator.
Lucas was the director of Marshall.
Okay.
Dick Smith was the head of CAPE.
Yes.
Worked for Marshall at one time.
Okay.
At Houston, it wasn't Chris Kraft, it was something. But everybody left at the Challenger. Lucas went, Dick Smith left.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody, you know, everybody essentially left their position.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, of course they resigned, but, you know, some people said, you know, they were fired, but they're really... Just the fact that everybody left. There were a lot of people who left. A lot of us just continued working.
Mm-hmm.
But the people just in the management area, including Lucas, didn't know exactly how to handle a crisis. I mean,
NASA had never experienced anything except for the Apollo 1 fire.
And Apollo fire back in that day, you know, you read a lot about that. that program manager down there, he, Joe, what's his name, you know, he bit the dust, but he was a nice fellow too. A lot of the, you know, these are good people.
I know. But they're not made of steel.
They're not made of steel, and they're not made to handle...
That would tear anybody up. Can you imagine? To take responsibility, have to take responsibility.
That's right.
But you mentioned something interesting about Rocco Patrone. That was the beginning of the end for the German continuity at Marshall. Apparently,
right.
He came in to clean house. Why? I have no idea.
I think it was just for me. I think it was the Johnson administration. I'm not. I don't know anything about Johnson, but Johnson was president at that.
Yeah.
We got the impression that the Johnson were pressed by the Jewish people. And we have good Jewish friends here, so
yeah.
I'm not kicking the Jewish people. But somehow,
wow.
The pressure was there, and Rocco, his personality would come from a military background that they can cut their heads off first, and then we'll see if they need him later.
You know, Von Braun left as director of the center and to go to headquarters. And I read that book there, and that one, and he knew it wasn't a promotion. It was lateral, if anything. And he did not have a good feeling about going, and it was justified when he got there.
And why he said to me, you always have to respect him, because he did go.
Yeah.
He could have been... He would have been a multi-million. I mean, if money was a question, Dr. Von Braun could have gone to any company and become the head of it, and he would have been a multi-millionaire. I mean, you know.
Well, ultimately, maybe too late. He did go. Some guy, I forget the name of the company that
right.
he had dealt with for years, and they made him a vice president, and it was like not ten times, but it was an order of magnitude more.
Order of magnitude what he made.
It was phenomenal. And he's probably worth it.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, the more you look at the man and see, he was a Renaissance man. He was an amazing man.
Yeah.
He wasn't just an engineer. He was a superb manager.
Yeah.
He cared about people. He's just, he really was amazing. I wish I'd gotten to know him and meet him.
Yeah, I do. But, see, a lot of the Germans were very caring and a lot of really good folks that I worked for.
Yes.
But some of them were tough as nails, like Carl Hamburg.
Kurt Debus was very, not severe, but he wasn't like Von Braun. He was
also a leader.
Yes.
And he worked very close with Warner and Von Braun.
Mm-hmm.
And Debus was another leader there who took us, you know, as far as the tape was concerned. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's sad when you look at a lot of this anime. But also, we can still get ourselves up, but I don't know. You got to have a leader to pull us out.
Yeah, that's
we
true.
We haven't had the leader.
No. I wrote a very interesting article for the Space Review. It's an online weekly. Sometimes I'll write a book review or a commentary or something. And one of them was when Johnson got its new center director, whose name escapes me, which doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Because my point was, there was Dr. Gilruth.
Yeah, oh yeah.
What a man. Then Chris Kraft, who was his deputy, who became director.
Right.
But nobody can remember the third one or the fourth. Or fifth. And it's like, each served almost 10 years as director.
That's right.
Through a very critical part. And then something political happened. It's like, whoever anybody wanted to be in there became senator. I'll email you the link so you can read the article. I think you'd find it fascinating because ever since, they've had forgettable center directors there at Johnson Space Center.
Yeah.
They are not of the caliber of Dr. Gilruth or Dr. Kraft.
No.
And their leadership was crucial, and the point of my article was, will the new Johnson Space Center director, as his first act, pick up the phone and call Chris Kraft and say, hey, let's have lunch. I want to pick your brains.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that, if I had, that's the first thing I would have done.
Yeah.
And who knows if he did. He was a former astronaut, then executive with one of the aerospace firms, and NASA tapped him to be the center director. I hope he does a good job, but he's got big shoes to fill. Johnson's a big center. But I'll send that. I think you'll find it interesting because it's because there are people in there you probably didn't even know. There was a lady who became center director for, and what was amazing too is that their tenure as director was amazingly brief. Sometimes months, maybe a year and a half, then they moved on some else.
Oh, yeah.
One, I guess the only female center director of Johnson went on to become a Environmental Protection Agency, something or other. I'm going, wait a minute. What does that have to do with, how'd she get this job? And then I say in the article, oh, I get it. She's a bureaucrat. They were nothing but bureaucrats. For a lot of them, now some of them were really good. They had excellent experience. They were involved at KSC or something, and they were good, but most of them are simply, they weren't qualified for the job, and they did nothing while they were there.
I don't remember their names.
It was like, it was a special era of men and women who came up during that time who were put in all these key positions. Another article I wrote is called The Legacy of Great Men.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I'll send you a link for that,
too.
That'd
be great.
Because I say Apollo had so many highly qualified men in the right positions at the right time that Apollo was a success.
Yeah.
It really, when you look at the whole panorama of who was where and doing what, it's like the pieces of a magnificent puzzle that made it all come together. We did it in 8.5 years. You say that to people, how did we ever do that? Sonny Maria said, we'd never be able to do that today.
Oh, no.
And to this day, he can't believe he did the rover program in less than 18 months. And that's true.
Yeah.
It was a whole different mindset of how they get to...
But it was also exciting times. I mean, you know, it was a time in which you really enjoyed doing the work.
Yes.
I mean, you really enjoyed it. My last years, I can tell her, you know, the worst thing is when you're having to lay people off across the country.
Yeah.
And that was tough. That was tough. And,
well, you also got into personnel and...
Personnel and...
That was not fun for you.
But that was not fun.
No. It never is. How can you know?
Yeah.
You want to be hiring people, not laying them off.
You want to be hiring them, not laying them off. I hated that. But back in the Apollo days, I mean, partially loved it. I mean, you could go out. Test lab people were tough as nails, too. They wouldn't let anybody out there, you know, Carl Lambert. Well, eventually he became the director of the design lab. And he mellowed it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But back in the Apollo day, you know, he wouldn't even let Rudolph out there. You know, unless he said, if you don't have a reason to be out here, I don't want you out here. He said, all I want to do is just watch the test. He said, I'll tell you what happened to the test.
Wow.
And he did that. But we had good relationships, and, but they were tough. I mean, some of them were tough, but they was, hey, we just enjoyed a lot of things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, any one or two particular moments that stand out in your mind with regard to the F1 program, whether it's witnessing a test or some event or something like that?
When I was at Edwards, and I was out there a lot, watching the engine, but during the qualification, it was so exciting to sit there, go through the process of having a, you know, 1.5 million pounds of truck, you know, start up and move like a, I mean,
the power was just astounding.
The powerfulness was just great. And when we fired it out here, oh gosh, you know, it really just tingled everything. To see much, that much power is just amazing. You will never have that much power. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, the most exciting thing.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the main things, you know, working on the effort, on the effort.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to stand next to it and just see how big and tall it was. Know that you're a part of, you know, had a lot to do with the interfacing of Boeing and all that.
I want to make sure, can you give me your title at the time when you first started and as you progressed through the F-1 program?
I was the F-1 project engineer for the laboratory.
And the laboratory was?
Propulsion Visual Engineering Lab.
Okay.
That's what it was.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And that was under the
yes.
And back in that day, during the early systems, you had to have an engineer that actually coordinated all of the work for your laboratory that went to the program office. And if any information or anything that was of design nature or anything that the program manager needed, you designated somebody like myself to work that with the lab, as well as Boeing, who was our contractor on the F1C, to assure that all the interfaces were met on the those 5 inches.
Well, that's a good point, that the interface. Did you who did you work with, can you remember, with regard to integrating the F1 with the
system? I worked with a guy named Don Sapp. Don Sapp was the guy that was responsible.
Mm-hmm.
For Rockwell, back in that day,
he
died.
Mm-hmm.
But Don Sapp was the guy that, from Rockwell that we worked with.
Rockwell, not Boeing?
Boeing came in, as far as the interfacing, interconnection is concerned, Rockwell was, was an integrator.
Okay.
Boeing was the guy that actually built it.
Okay.
You see the integrator?
Yes, I understand now. Mm-hmm.
Rockwell had a lot to do with the integration of the contract.
I'm glad you told me that, because that's the first I've heard of it. I was trying to find out who was that, what company was that, or who was involved in making sure that...
But now the Boeing people were the guys that built it, and they built it, you know, in our own manufacturing facility there, and then they eventually moved it on down to Michoud.
To Michoud, right. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
And, but that's how they came in. But you had to have an integrator, you know, back in that day, you know, we always had an integrator.
Okay.
Did a lot of integration.
Okay, good. That answers the question there.
And they integrated like the SSME to the shuttle.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what I remember.
Well, Rockwell was the prime contractor for the shuttle, wasn't it?
Yeah.
When it came about. Okay.
Yeah. Right. So they were primary. And we had people. See, Boeing didn't get that. Boeing got that contract, I think it
I've got a date somewhere when that's awarded. The initial approval and then. It's like, it's trying to understand the contract structure NASA does.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not just boom, one contract and it's done. It's like there are several contracts leading up to final production. Sometimes there are...
Now, Anthony, you know, sometimes I get the SSME and shuttle mixed up so much with the rocket.
Okay.
That I may... And I know...
I didn't know that... Okay, here's my question. When you kept saying Rockwell, I said, as a company, I didn't know Rockwell went back that far. I thought it was a...
No, Rockwell, Rocketdyne had Rockwell as their, you know, they had, that was a corporate company.
Well, there's...
And Rockwell was a division.
Yeah, well, Rocketdyne was a division of North American Aviation.
I mean, North American.
Yes,
okay.
Yeah.
This was North American I'm talking about.
Okay, great.
Okay,
I understand now.
I'm
yes.
Sorry.
All right.
North American.
All right, okay.
It was North America.
Okay.
It was the, okay. I think it was the integrator. I'd have to look back on my notes.
Okay.
But I was thinking Don Sapp was involved.
Okay, well, you've given me a lot of good names here. I can... also got the name of Frank Bafola. Does that ring a bell?
Frank Bafola.
He's down in Newport Richey, not too far from me, so
Frank
I'll probably pay
Frank
him a visit.
Funny guy. Is he? Italian guy that
you
enjoy. I mean, I don't know how Frank... I would think Bafola would probably be as old as Frank Stewart, but
okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
A lot of these guys are just good old... good folks.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them have passed on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And I won't be able to get their story, but I'll still put together a good one.
But there's a lot of good stories that I know Biggs, if he's still living,
yes,
will have good stories. If you could ever talk to Stu Mulligan, if you could get to him, I'm not sure. A lot of times he lives in Michigan somewhere, and I don't know exactly where.
Okay. I'm a pretty good detective when it comes to tracking people down.
Stu Mulligan is a good, he'd be a great man.
Okay.
We've worked problems, you know, between 2 and 4 in the morning is difficult in, when you're trying to, as far as sleeping is concerned, but when you're taking and you've already loaded for problems and you're trying to work problems, Stu was always a guy that we worked problems together.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know who
that's right up there. All right. Did you keep any materials or anything for the program at all? Sonny didn't. See, Sonny donated his entire LRV collection of every letter, memo, technical, everything you can imagine. Boxes and boxes he gave to the UAH archives some years ago. And they've cataloged everything. They must have 20 binders of the stuff. And it's that collection that made this book possible. I mean, not the only thing. I did the other interviews and material. But I was able to give a chronological history of the rover program in the context of the latter Apollo program
because
of that. So I always ask that question, did you keep any materials? It's amazing.
I'll look back. I was glancing back, and I've got every notebook from 1970 until I retired in 95. But from 1961 until 1970, when I started working on the SSMA, I'm trying to figure out what happened to that data. Unless I think what happened is I believe when the SSMA came up, we put it all in boxes. And somebody said, where do you want to do with this, Ron? And I said, well, just go and store it. And they said, well, we'll store it out in TEFLAB.
And who knows where it went from there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what happened to a lot of the things.
Okay.
But I do have, I mean, the only thing I have is, notes. You know, I was trying to pull some of this, like this data here. You know, this is, you probably have this data, right?
Let me see.
This is a good summary sheet of Apollo and Saturn V. You ever seen this data?
I've gotten quite a bit. The Saturn V news reference, I've got that. Yes, I do have this.
25th anniversary, 1960 to 1985. You have any?
No, I haven't seen this one.
I don't know whether that's...
Yeah, they did test the Shuttle Enterprise out in the dynamic test stand, didn't they?
Yeah.
That's interesting. And that thing's still standing, too, which is amazing to me.
Yeah, they, see, like here, this is in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of information, you know, here, how we were designated for engine problems, the propulsion division.
Okay.
And then this is how we were designated. F1 engine.
Okay.
Dick Rogers.
This would be handy. Well, what I can do is I can copy this. And if you want to loan it to me for a couple of days, I'll copy it and return it.
Yeah, just send it.
We can copy it.
Oh, copy it.
Oh, that'd be great. Sure.
Yeah,
yeah, that would help me.
Yeah, let me see if there's anything else.
Okay. You know, Harold Hall was just a jewel because he had these boxes and boxes of all these priceless, irreplaceable photographs that he'd kept in the attic literally for 40 years.
Oh, my God.
And he says, you can take what you want and just return it. You don't know how many times I've...